My name is Anton Mann and I'm Director of Policy and Research at the Education Employers Task Force. And it's my pleasure to welcome you to the seventh and last in the 2011 London Series of Seminars on themes surrounding employer engagement in education, co-sponsored by the Task Force and Centre for Education and Industry at the University of Warwick. Our speaker today is Professor Louise Archer. Still early in her career, Louise has established herself as one of the most important sociologists of education in the UK. Through a series of influential books and extensive range of articles, she is a leading figure in trying to understand issues of identity and inequality in compulsory and post-compulsory education. A prolific and effective collaborator, her co-authored book, Urban Youth and Schooling, provides profound insights for policymakers and practitioners alike on how young people from different backgrounds make sense of their educational experiences. So the pleasure and privilege is mine today to introduce Professor Louise Archer.
Hello. Thank you very much for inviting me here. I'm absolutely delighted to be here. I'm going to talk today about some research that we're still doing on young people's science and career aspirations. So I assume this begs the question to start with, well, why even study aspirations? Obviously, they're assumed to matter, and this is quite evident in lots of policies and the current policy interest in raising aspirations. So aspirations, obviously, as you know, often taken as a source of motivation for young people to engage with education and seen as part of the problem of educational disengagement and low achievement. I'm going to suggest that aspirations are very useful to study, but we need to be very careful with them. They need very careful treatment. They're quite complex. Children often hold multiple aspirations at the same time, not of all of them consistent with one another. And of course, they shift over time. Obviously, my childhood dream wasn't exactly to become a professor in a university, but obviously it's my dream job now, but I didn't imagine that when I was younger. So I'm going to suggest that obviously aspirations are not predictive, but they are socially indicative. So they do tell us quite a lot about young people and the situations that they're in. And the approach that I take to aspirations is to see them as very much socially embedded. So they're not just individual interests or personal cognitions, they're very much social products. We have agency, but not within the conditions of our own choosing. And in particular, I'm interested in aspirations as illuminating social inequalities. So the example I'm going to give today is on our project on children's science aspirations. Obviously, this research is set against a more widespread concern in post-16 participation rates in science, that there are low participation, particularly in the physical sciences, and also that girls and some ethnic minority groups don't participate in equal proportions. And our starting point is age 10 to 14 is a sort of a critical period for forming views about science and science aspirations. The existing evidence suggests that children's ideas about science are largely formed by 14, and it's all downhill from then on. So we're interested in, well, what happens over this sort of critical age period? And existing evidence from the States by Tai et al. Also suggests that science aspirations are very important for predicting future science participation. So they found that at age 14, students with expectations to go into science-related careers are more than three times more likely to gain a degree in physical sciences or engineering than equally qualified students without such an aspiration. So the research I'm talking about is our ongoing five-year longitudinal study funded by the Economic and Social Research Council. We're about halfway through it now. It's part of a larger programme of research projects. There are five projects in the wider TISME programme, which I'm also the lead coordinator of. And our study uses mixed methods. We're following a cohort of children from primary and picking up at three age points until they get to secondary, so from age 10 to 14. We're using a large-scale national survey in England, and we're using in-depth qualitative work as well with parents and pupils. So the data I'm talking about today is our phase one data. So that's the survey with over 9,000 pupils and 170 interviews with children aged 10, 11 and their parents. And right now, we're currently in the middle of phase two, so we're doing the survey and the interviews for that. We've also got an intervention, which I'm not going to talk about, but just in case anyone is interested, we're working with teachers to develop ways of teaching about integrating careers awareness knowledge into Key Stage 3. So the first point that I'd like to begin with is perhaps quite obvious, but that there is a complex relationship between liking or enjoying a subject, doing well in it, engaging with it, and choosing to study it later on. and that none of these follow directly on from one another. If you like it, it doesn't mean you necessarily want to study it later, and so on. So, for example, we did find examples among some children of what we called pragmatic engagement. So, particularly among some of our South Asian pupils, lots of them did very well in science. They were planning to take science for the qualifications in the future, but they didn't actually have an interest in it. They were predominantly interested in using it to get to high-status medical career. But over and above that, we found a more widespread distinction between what we called the being-doing distinction. So when we asked in our survey, we asked our children a range of things, including, like, did they like science in school? So said, you can see over 70% said, I learn interesting things in science. Their parents think science is important. They have generally positive views of scientists. For example, they think they make a positive difference in the world. And well over 70% talked about doing science-related activities in their spare time out of school. But when we asked, would you like to become a scientist, less than 17% envisaged that as a potential future career. So we're interested in that disjuncture. So from our 9,000-plus survey responses, the majority of children were what you might call interested but. They all like science and they do it, but it's not for me. We did find, as you can see there, 648 who were what you might call a hardcore disinterested in science. They sort of responded very negatively to all the various items we had around science and aspirations. And a smaller hardcore were very science keen. They responded very positively to all the items. And as you can see, there were more boys in that group than girls. And our science keen children were, as you might expect, predominantly middle class, white and or South Asian, especially so among the girls. So we're interested in, well, what shapes aspirations. When we did multilinear modelling of our survey data, we found that parental attitudes, experiences of school science and self-concept in science explained a lot of the variance. We combined this then with qualitative analyses of the interviews with the children and their parents, and we were interested that the personal interests, attitudes and dispositions were very much shaped by the social context that children are in. And so I'm going to now talk particularly about the role of what we call capital, family habitus and social and cultural discourses, and how these all play a role in shaping what children feel as their personal interest. So the notion of capital that we're drawing on, being a sociologist, is Bourdieu's notion of capital, which combines economic capital, so money, the money that families have that can facilitate the development and pursuit of interests, social capital, so social contacts, networks, and cultural capital, so the qualifications, the knowledge, the kind of understanding of the rules of the educational game, that sort of understanding and knowledge. And we've also developed what for us is kind of a handy short-term, shorthand term of science capital. And we found that this is quite a useful way of trying to encapsulate some of these things to talk about the differences between families. So in this, we're interested in the role that families' science-related qualifications, their knowledge, their interest and appreciation of science, their kind of scientific literacy and their social contacts in science can play a role in fostering children's aspirations. And I'm going to suggest that, unsurprisingly, the more science capital you have, the more likely children are to have science-related aspirations. So one of our first findings in this area was that science capital is not very common. Generally, across the children and parents, there was a real lack of knowledge of the breadth and diversity of careers that can come from science qualifications. Obviously, children tended to name three sorts of jobs that science leads to. You can become a scientist, a science teacher, or a doctor. And there's a quote there from a boy, and a beautiful illustration that the Science Council kindly funded and commissioned for us, just illustrating that, that there's sort of no knowledge of the diversity of routes that science qualifications can lead to. And this really affects children's and families' perceptions of the usefulness of why would you study science in the future? What's the value of those qualifications? We also mapped the extent of science capital among our participating families and found a very uneven spread. More affluent families were more likely to possess more science capital and to report more positive parental views of science. And obviously, the more science capital you had, as I said, the more likely the child was to have science aspirations. So it's disproportionately located in the middle classes. And we saw it as really important for being able to grow and nurture and develop children's science aspirations. So children across the board would like science or aspire to it, but the more capital you have, the more you're able to grow and build on those aspirations rather than kind of withering and fading away. So it can make science very visible, high profile in everyday life. So the families, you know, everything we read is science related, or we talk about science related programmes. It can offer very practical instances for children to gain experience and mastery of science related concepts, and, you know, so family building olive oil lava lamps, I think, was one of the examples. And obviously cultivating a valuing of science within families. There was also an interaction between what we call family habitus and science capital. So the kind of the taken for granted values and practices that happen within families, the ways of thinking about the world that are cultivated within individual families. And we found that although science capital was generally quite patchy, those middle class families who didn't have it were much better at compensating for that and building on existing children's science interests. So they would go out and be able to find the activities to go and do. They would take up their aspiration and use what the sociologist Annette Leroux calls a practice of concerted cultivation, where the family really treats the child as a project rather than leaving the child to, what she calls, develop the accomplishment of natural growth. So rather than just letting them be, the child is the project. And speaking as one of those types of mothers, I know exactly what she means. It's everything is educational. In contrast, science capital is very much absent and peripheral in many of the working class and minority ethnic families we talked to, and there's just a quote there which was very typical. Children would say, you know, what do your parents think of science? And they say, I haven't got a clue, no idea, we never talk about it, they never talk about it. And parents as well would also say, well, we're not very sciencey. Or as another mother said, I suppose in everyday life you don't really get that much to do with science. So this idea of science as an absent presence in the everyday. So science capital enables families to grow and build on any nascent interest among children. And we very much felt that some of the working class children who had a general interest in science, it was kind of in danger of withering away. It was not getting supported on multiple fronts. Within this, we're drawing on wider work conducted by Stephen Ball and Carol Vincent to understand how different families use different sources of knowledge in different ways in their educational decision making. And like their research, they distinguish between hot and cold knowledge, and they suggest that middle class families tend to be much better and more adept at using and accessing what they call cold knowledge, so kind of a formal, official sources of knowledge and information, whether brochures, prospectuses, the internet. Whereas working class families tend to put more weight on hot interpersonal grapevine knowledge. So that's seen as less impartial, more reliable, more trusted. And this again affects how families engage with aspirations and sources of knowledge about potential future careers. We're also interested in the role of social and cultural discourses and how these also complicate the relationship between interest, engagement, achievement and participation. And one of the things we picked up in this respect was the cultural arts-science divide, what C.P. Snow famously referred to as the two cultures. So here, even where we had children like Tom, who did really well in science, he went to an independent school, he liked science, he was achieving highly, he thought his teachers were excellent, he said, I just can't really picture myself being a scientist. And it kind of tied in with a family identity discourse that his mum was picking up on, about them as an arty family. This is what we do, we all do the arts, there's a family history of it. And as she says, we know more arts people than science people. And we think there's a link here with wider societal discourses, particularly in England. I think the discourse of specialisation is very strong. And we're suggesting here that it's important to remember that people aren't entirely quote-unquote rational. Participation doesn't necessarily follow from interest or from aptitude, but it can link to your sense of identity and the wider social context, the sorts of discourses that circulate there. So people, it's this idea again of people as socially embedded actors. And in terms of what we do about it, it means sort of recognising that we can't just undo all the taken for granted knowledge that people have been socialised into of this is how we think about the world, but it needs a sort of more careful engagement with it. That's just we had these illustrations commissioned and just nice to use them. Is there ways that would involve trying to bridge the so-called arts science divide? And obviously there are lots of organisations that are engaged in that sort of work. And our research also points to the role played by the cultural discourses and stereotypes of aspirations, which are quite complex. Now, we found evidence of both the crude and the complex. So the first one is a quote from Victoria, sort of my dad thinks science is cool because he used to study it. Most scientists wear glasses, and I don't want to wear glasses, and they're a bit brainy, and I don't want to be brainy. So we did have that sort of discourse, but it wasn't the most prevalent. There were a few of them. More often than not, students simultaneously expressed a meritocracy discourse. Anyone can do science. They, you know, they'd all learned that that's the right thing in the world, that anyone can do it. But they also had trouble reconciling that with their perception, but that not anybody does. That only particular sorts of people actually seem to go on and do it. So the general views aren't translating into personal choices to study it. So we try to pick up a bit further on this idea of aspirations as linked to identity, and how that's both identity in terms of perceptions of the self and how you perceive others who might do that potential future career. So there was a clear finding in our study that science is linked to cleverness. So as you see there, over 81% of the survey strongly agreed or agreed that scientists are brainy. As you can imagine, the science-keen children in our study were also predominantly high achievers. And we also asked children what their perceptions were of their peers in their classrooms who they thought were really into science. And most of them would say, they're really brainy, they're really clever, they're geniuses, things like that. So we're suggesting that age 10, 11, children who don't identify themselves as super brainy already have learnt that science is not for me in the future. I might like it, but that's not for me. And we think that's quite a concern. Obviously that links to wider issues around what progression routes there are post-16. So I just wanted to also mention gender. And again, there was a very strong recognition, despite decades of very useful intervention work, that science is predominantly masculine and for boys. And we found this association between among both parents and children, although it must be said the parents were quite divided in their views as to whether they saw the reasons for that as what we might call genetic biology based, like boys just like science better, or whether there's a recognition of social cultural factors in that, i.e. you know, it's societal inequalities that create that situation. But the underlying issue is that science is linked with masculinity. So in the analysis I've been doing recently, I've been looking at those girls who did identify with science and those girls who didn't, to look at their aspirations in a bit more detail. And it's quite striking that for the girls who had science aspirations, it was quite a difficult identity. It requires a lot of identity work to reconcile that with being a normal girl. And I think the notion of the abnormality of science as a career aspiration for girls was underlined by the enormous lengths that our parents went to emphasise that their girls who had science career aspirations were normal, they were balanced, they were rounded. And obviously it's good to be balanced and rounded, but we think it sort of speaks to something about science as an aspiration for girls as well. So Elizabeth there is talking about her daughter Hayley, and saying that it's nice that she's normal as well. So she has an interest in clothes and fashion and shoes and pop music alongside science. And then for those girls who didn't have science aspirations, we're suggesting that often science is quite unthinkable for them, and particularly for working class and minority ethnic girls. I've been categorising their career aspirations, and basically they pretty much fall into three types. There's nurturing careers, there's what I call X-factor jobs, glamour, girly careers, and there's active sports-related careers. And really, science here is seen as not fitting with their perceived competency, so particularly for some of our working-class learners, the notion of being clever, a brainy academic, and very intellectual doesn't fit with what they feel comfortable with or what seems as normal for people like me. And also it's not fitting with their visions of what desirable femininity is either. And there's just a couple of quotes there from mothers. It's not very girly, not sexy, not glamorous. And I think the notion of whether a lab coat would suit her daughter is also quite interesting. So just, practically done. Just to finish off, I won't talk too much about this, but we've also been looking at the way that discourse around science aspirations interweave with cultural stereotypes around science, which is, as the literature says, widely perceived as white male and middle class, and how this fits with discourses around academic achievement, which I've written about elsewhere in a book with Becky Francis, which tend to be race, classed and gendered in such a way that the ideal pupil is often comes out as white male, middle class as well. Some of our students had sort of found ways around this, and I mentioned at the beginning with the notion of pragmatic engagement, there are strong cultural discourses that value science as a qualification that will get you to a high status future job, often in medicine. And then I've also put there about our linked student, PhD student who's just finished his PhD, and he was looking at minority ethnic students in secondary schools and their engagement or not with science and aspirations. And he also interviewed teachers and found that teachers in his study thought it was virtually impossible for Black Caribbean students to study science. And I think there are quite strong issues there around racist constructions of particular groups of students and what's possible or impossible for them that have real impact and real consequences. And again, these all come together to make science unthinkable for particular groups of students. So just to sum up, I think our kind of key messages are, really it's underlining the complexity of the relationship between aspirations, enjoyment, engagement, and that should be participation as well. The notion, as I said, of aspirations as social constructs, not just personal cognitions, and I think a lot of policy texts still talk about aspirations as that personal idea inside your head, not as socially embedded. I'd like to flag up that we think families are very important in the development and nurturing or not of aspirations, and family resources and capital is quite key there. Obviously we're talking about children aged 10-11, but I still think there's an interesting case for bringing in a slightly wider look rather than just the individual child as the focus of attention in the field of aspirations. Obviously, I think it's an issue not just of raising aspirations. Often lots of families have quite high aspirations, but there are issues around how they become achievable and thinkable as well. So as I said, the notion of aspirations being thinkable is bringing in both being conceivable for children and their families and also achievable, so looking at what social inequalities are there blocking it. In relation to science in particular, I think there's a need to broaden and deepen families' science capital, particularly the notion of awareness of what qualifications can lead to. Challenging dominant societal discourses around, for example, specialisation, and particularly challenging cultures of exclusivity. I think this is sort of, there are lots of high status careers that have particular cultural assumptions attached to them, which can be quite difficult to break down. I think there's a challenge for ensuring that new knowledge is delivered in appropriate formats for different social groups, or that takes account of social differences. And finally, I just wanted to sort of sum up that I think the study of aspirations, while it seems very aspirant, very sort of nebulous and not tied to anything concrete, can be useful for coming up with concrete policy recommendations. And I know that in our study, we've sort of fed in what we think are quite concrete ideas for example, the National Curriculum Review that's currently ongoing and things around the diversity of post 16 routes. So I shall stop there, hopefully within time.
Great, thank you very much.